Stand by to be influenced. Welcome to Flat Chat. I'm Stuart Codling, and as the latest edition of GP Racing magazine slides onto the shelves and thuds, hopefully, onto subscribers' doormats, I know that there have been a few problems with the post, not to slide into Alan Partridge mode straight away, and we're looking forward to the season finally starting. And we, this month, are beginning the first in our seven-part series, looking at the most influential people in the seven decades of the World Championship history. So joining me as usual are Mark Gallagher.
Good to be talking to you again.
And you're looking sort of all fresh and neat in your lovely office there. I've got the smell of polish in my nostrils here because I actually polished the desk in here at the weekend just to be nice and keep things prim during lockdown. As we say hello to Ben Anderson, it's like, could that even be Ben Anderson? Because all I can see is a silhouette against some sort of bedroom backdrop. He could be like someone who's anonymized and about to give evidence voiced by an actor. Hello, Ben Anderson.
Hello. Is it me? Is it really me that you're hearing? Welcome to my new special security system.
you should have done, apparently, to disguise your voice, you do this. You can talk through a pen. You clasp a pen. No, that doesn't work.
No, it sounds it sounds like you've been to the dentist.
Have you often had to disguise your voice online, Stuart? Is that something you regularly have to do?
No, I don't do kidnappings and things like that. Anyhow, so yeah, a new issue of GP Racing magazine, hot on the heels of the last one, because what happened with the schedule, Ben, that caused us to have to do one in 3 weeks?
Well, obviously everything's been a bit crazy in lockdown. This is our sixth issue of the year, I think, with no racing in it, and our second full issue done since the UK went into lockdown. And of course, while we were planning our business strategy in the early stages of lockdown, we didn't know how things were going to go, what was going to go in the magazine. So for a couple of issues, we gave ourselves an extra week to produce the thing. And of course, that put us off a regular monthly cycle. And with F1, you know, for a while now, looking like it was going to restart, as it should do, at the beginning of July, at some point, we needed to bite the bullet and get back on track with our regular schedule, so we can have issues every 4 weeks for the rest of the year. And yeah, a superhuman effort to get the June issue out very shortly after the May issue, so we can get back to the new normal.
This month, we've interviewed someone with a triple-barreled surnames, Jacoby, Anstruther, Gough, Calthorpe, Llanfilippe, Gerigogogoch, or something like that. But even more exciting than that, we've welcomed back one of the UK's best sports writers to our pages. Richard Williams is the author of several excellent books, including the recently published A Race with Love and Death biography of Richard Seaman, which I recall reading on my deck chair in the early days of lockdown, back when it was sunny before winter arrived.
Is it a good book?
It's a very good book. It's brilliant. Yeah.
And, I've got it on my shelves. I don't know about you guys, but one of the things I've been doing during lockdown has been ordering books online that I'm going to store up for reading. So I've got that yet to go through. But it looks good. I had a quick peruse, but did you manage to finish it?
Oh, yeah. I finished it in two sittings over a sunny weekend back in sort of March, early April. The one I'm working my way through at the moment is Morris Hamilton's biography of Niki Lauda, which I managed to blag a review copy of, and we've run a piece on it in this month's GP Racing. Also a really good piece of work, really nice, sort of a compliment to Niki's own autobiography, because it's, I think Morris has tracked down and spoken to anyone who's ever worked with him or knew him, and that sort of just a different perspective on his life, really. So we actually, I wouldn't say a glut, but we've got quite a good stock of interesting books coming out at the beginning of this year. Another thing that we've got hopefully coming for review is there's a new Pete Lyons book about Shadow, because it's the 50th anniversary of Shadow making their debut in Can-Am before moving to Formula One. So that should be pretty interesting. But we've digressed, haven't we?
You'll have to make space by removing some of those Hitler biographies from your shelves, Mark.
Yes, that's very true. I should add that most of them have to do with interwar motorsport, and it's not purely about any fascination with Nazism as a particular thing. Although it is an interesting study of leadership before the Jean-Marie Balestre, Bernie Eccleston era of motorsport.
Bit of politics.
Yeah, exactly. Just to throw that in there. Hopefully Bernie's not listening to the podcast. There we go.
He probably doesn't know how these things work, do they?
It's a bit digital for him, isn't it?
No one makes any money out of podcasts. Why would he listen to one? Yeah. But there is, I think, do you remember, have you ever come across Jim Wiseman, not the Sisters of Mercy collaborator and record producer, but brother of Richard Wiseman, who's the great archivist and an archive scour of motor racing. He's done a TV program about Nazi sports car races or something, which I assume will be on one of these digital channels. You know, basically, I think if there's anything you need to know about Nazi Germany, it's on Sky TV somewhere, isn't it? Down on Discovery Turbo or Discovery Shed or something like that. We've massively digressed, haven't we? Yeah. Should we talk about influencers? Let's talk about 1950s and the influencers, because yes, seven-part series. It's on the cover of this month's GP Racing, and I sent you a PDF, Mark, but you've actually managed to get hold of a physical copy of our magazine, so you'll have read it and enjoyed it already.
I have read the magazine. It's an extremely good edition. I have to say page 25 was totally riveting.
Of course, that was we'll come to that in a little bit.
Come to that in a moment. But no, I enjoy, and actually what's really interesting about the influencers features, how do I put this politely, but I mean, I've worked in racing for quite a long time, 35 years or more, and there was a generation of media around in the 80s and 90s who knew many of the people that are now being written about in a feature like this. And of course, that's not the case with kind of the more modern generation of media. They just weren't around at that time. So it's been very interesting to go from an era when, you know, you would meet people in the paddock who actually knew Mike Hawthorne, or who'd met Ascari or Fangio, or perhaps even reported on races and such like. And of course, now this very much is the history of the sport. And I love the feature. I mean, I must say, when I think about influencers and you start talking about the 1950s, I mean, Enzo Ferrari is writ large across my view of that period, because Ferrari being the only team that's competed in the World Championship every season, Formula One World Championship every season since 1950, and his legacy is just so huge. And then you've got Fangio. And so, you know, Ferrari and Fangio were such obvious ones to have. But then looking at the other names that have cropped up in the influencer list, I mean, you don't have to dig very far. It just goes on and on. So many people who played a significant part in the creation of the sport that we still enjoy today.
I think it's important that we approach this feature not trying to rank people or say that one person was more influential than another by this degree, because I think you can tie yourself up in knots. And I think Formula One itself fell into that trap. I think they tried to have a bit of a game online, you know, round robining people off against each other, and you just end up in trouble, because there are certain names through the history of the sport that, you know, undeniably had a massive influence over the whole thing, and everyone else just pales into insignificance by comparison.
Who had the brilliant idea of putting Princess Grace in as an influencer? Because I thought that was actually quite inspired.
It was Richard Williams, actually. What we did was Ben wrote an initial list, because when we actually, I think if memory serves, we delayed the start of this feature because we wanted to get it right. And as Ben says, we didn't want to make it a list with boxes. And I kind of thought that Richard was the sort of author who might find it a little bit boring or not his cup of tea if he just got given a commission saying, can you write seven boxes or 10 boxes per month of X number of words about a particular person, and we're ranking them in order. He'd probably have thought that was a bit fatuous. So we thought it would just look nicer if it was written through cleverly, which he's done. He's sort of tied it together in a neat thread of continuous prose. And Ben wrote an initial list, and we circulated it in our high-tech Microsoft Teams system, and we nudged it around a bit, and we sent it to Richard, and he said, oh, I would be delighted to work for your magazine again. Could I make a few suggestions, and he sent this thing back with Princess Grace in it. And I thought, yeah, fine. If you can stand that up, Richard, then by all means.
It is inspired because, I mean, I don't think he refers to it in the article, but the I mean, Graham Hill, famously kind of Mr. Monaco, he said, one of his reasons he was so good around Monaco was that you got to kiss Grace Kelly at the end of the race if you won it, and that and that became his motivation. And I thought that was such it's probably true, probably for Graham Hill that took on such a special event. It was the blue ribboned event in the Formula One calendar. It was the one everyone wanted to win, and I think that's still the case very much to this day. And I know if you talk to David Coulthard or Mark Webber or Daniel Ricciardo or any of those guys, about Monaco, they will tell you that how important a victory there really is for a driver.
You could also say it's very rigorous to feature Grace Kelly as an influencer in that regard, because the Monaco Grand Prix was almost dead in the water for a bit, wasn't it? It was on in 1950, and then there was a sports car race in, 52, but it didn't come back until 55, I think, off the top of my head.
Yeah.
And they'd had all sorts of problems with, obviously, Rainier had fought against Germany in the war, whereas his dad, the Crown Prince of Monaco at the time, had sort of disappeared off to live with his lover, I think, somewhere in France, and had sort of left to its own devices, and Monaco was regarded as a place that was a bit decadent and dissolute, and not a particularly salubrious place, and Rainier and Grace Kelly sort of made it that, it gave it that glamour rather than being just sort of Las Vegas on sea, really.
Yeah, it was the Somerset Maugham, wasn't it, who famously said it was a sunny place for shady people.
Yes, yes. I think he was referring to the whole Riviera, though. But
just specifically Monte Carlo. Okay.
Well, Codders, you know, because you've written a book about Monaco, haven't you?
Oh, have I? Oh, yes, I have. Yes, copies still available. The Life Monaco Grand Prix by Stuart Godding, from all good bookshops and Amazon. But yes, yeah, fascinating place. There is actually a chapter in that book about the Riviera in literature, because Grace Kelly was introduced to that area. She visited Monaco for the first time because she was in To Catch a Thief with Cary Grant, I think.
And right, yeah, that's right.
Went there, yeah. So all like Graham Greene lived there for a bit. You had Somerset Maugham lived on around not Villefranche-sur-Mer, but Saint-Jean-Cap-Ferrat. Yeah, yep. that sort of way on. So Charlie Chaplin lived on Cap-Ferrat. His house fell into the hands of David Niven, and another famously dissolute venue for Hollywood parties in the 1960s and 1970s. So fascinating. We've digressed again, haven't we? Let's move on to some other contents of this month's issue, because we've done a huge interview with Robert Kubica. And
when you say we, you mean you have?
I did. So big, long WhatsApp call. Went on for ages. Normally you interview a driver and you get 10 or 15 minutes. And we were on for the best part of an hour, and we only sort of cut it off because he had another call to go on to. And he was enjoying it massively, because we talked about Zwift, which is the online cycling platform, which he does a hell of a lot of, and he actually said he'd been doing too much, like twice a day doing racing and training, and he'd had to stop doing it a little bit, and he'd tried to do some esports but then got too competitive and that sucked him in, so he's now having to play off his esports against his Zwift. So we had quite a good chat about that. We did talk a little bit about Formula One, and it's interesting because the pandemic has actually caused Robert a fair bit of aggro, because he had a really, really busy year planned with dovetailing F1 and his DTM campaign, and now he's got kind of probably not very much at all, because he was going to be driving an F1 car in some free practice sessions. Will he actually be doing that this year?
Yeah, difficult to say, isn't it? I mean, he was fastest on one of the days of pre-season testing as well, wasn't he?
Actually, the only thing we didn't discuss was obviously his injury and what he refers to as his limitation, because I kind of thought that the viewers are a little bit or the listeners, readers are a little bit bored with that because it's been done to death. And maybe that's why we had such an enjoyable chat, because he's very bored with talking about that as well. We talked about 2008 and the championship that never was. And that was partly because we were doing for our sister magazine, Autosport, doing a 50 years of Sauber package where we were doing a feature about 2008, and I wanted to milk him for his thoughts on that. And
he's not
he hasn't changed his mind. He's not bitter, but he hasn't changed his mind. And at the time, he said it was a mistake to stop developing the car, and they stopped developing the car for whatever reason. And the interesting thing he said, now looking back in hindsight, I think that someone senior must have known that there was the chance that BMW would pull out of Formula One unless things changed. And so obviously at the time, BMW weren't very happy with the V8 homologated engine regulations, and they saw KERS as a good story of technology transfer between the racetrack and the road. And then of course the KERS system they designed was terrible, and they absolutely sucked in 2009. So having shifted development to the 2009 car early and burned 2008, they were left with a car that was nowhere. And he basically said after the Hungarian Grand Prix, right, see you after the summer break, and 2 days later got a phone call saying we're pulling out of Formula One.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. He makes a comment in the article about effectively you've got to seize the moment when it arrives. And you have to completely agree with that. The period during which any individual athlete or racing driver or any individual team reaches their kind of peak moment, it then becomes a moment you have to seize, because some people have a heyday that lasts for years, as in the case of Lewis Hamilton. Others have a single year when everything comes together in just the right order. And I mean, you can sense the frustration that comes through, because it's for him the one that got away. And I can relate to it insofar as my experience when I was at Jordan Grand Prix, and we were in a small team that then discovered a season, 1999, and we talked about this in the previous podcast, when for a whole bunch of reasons, including some of the inherent weaknesses in the other teams, we had our chance and we had to seize it, and we seized it and, you know, won those two Grand Prix and had a tip at the World Championship. It exhausted the team. It meant that Jordan was never competitive again in many respects, and you can lead it back to that 99 season. And I think for Robert and for the BMW Sauber team in Hinville, 2008 was their moment. And it's a shame that, you know, they had the rug slightly pulled from under their feet. I would doubt very much that anyone at BMW was saying, oh, well, you know, we're going to pull out of Formula One, or we're not happy with the engine regulation, so we're going to just, you know, we're going to take our foot off the gas pedal. I think it's probably as simple as leadership not understanding the moment that they had in front of them, and actually trying to have too big a picture about it and thinking, oh, we'll start planning for next year. Sometimes it does to just actually forget about the long term. Let's focus on getting next week's results and keep the momentum going. And I think that actually showed maybe the lack of full understanding of, you know, of Formula One in terms of a sporting challenge. When that moment arrives where you find yourself competitive, you've really got to keep pushing at that moment. There's no point in trying to be clever about it and saying, how do we build for the future? Let's just go and win some more races.
Yeah, I think they probably surprised themselves, didn't they, in how competitive they were that season. Like Robert says in the feature, they had a target to maybe win a race, and then he did that in Canada, albeit in slightly fortuitous circumstances. And then that was kind of it. They thought, oh, we've hit that target, so that's 08 done. Now we're going to have to reinvent our own wheel if we really want to take another step. And obviously, as you mentioned, KERS was obviously on the horizon. That was something they invested a lot in, and it didn't really work out. But I guess you can never know. And they wouldn't have known, I suppose, how chaotic the second half of that season would have been. You know, Kubica only ended up 23 points away from winning the championship. But, you know, Massa probably should have won it if he hadn't had that fuel rig disaster in Singapore. He would have done. Robert felt that with the aerodynamic updates they had in the pipeline that they saved for 09, he would have been more competitive. But the question is how much more in the second half of the year? Because if you look at his qualifying record, he was qualifying often quite a way down the field and then coming through in races that, as I mentioned, were quite chaotic. So if he had those parts on the car, sure, he would have been quicker. But would it have made the difference between turning some of those, you know, fourth places and thirds into seconds or wins? I mean, he says he might have won the Japanese, or probably would have won the Japanese Grand Prix in the rain against Alonso. And that's a race where Massa and Hamilton drove into each other. Would he have added many more big results in that portion of the season that would have turned the championship battle in his favour? I mean, he was always an outsider. And I think I accept the regret that they didn't go for it. And in hindsight, when that was your only year, that you could have had a proper shot at it, you will feel like that. And he says that some of the people in the team still feel that way. But I doubt whether it would have really changed the game. They would have had to have one of these magic bullet solutions in the pipeline that just don't exist anymore, even in that period of Formula One.
It shows again the importance of a team, drivers, management, all being fully aligned. What are we trying to do today, tomorrow, next weekend, next month, next year? And the moment that alignment splits, you've got a fundamental problem, because if a driver starts to sense that the team is moving away in a different direction, if maybe the focus isn't quite yet there, when actually the driver is supposed to be 100% focused on his task. And I think sort of a general comment I would make on sort of modern era of Formula One is that the drivers perhaps have slightly less influence than they used to have, where in the former days, a driver would have a particularly close relationship with the team principal and probably with the technical director. And those three people, you know, I'm talking about the lead driver, would very often influence the direction of the team and say, this is what we have to do for next weekend, for next month, for next whatever. And I think the driver as a contracted employee, which is kind of what we have now, somehow has diminished their ability to influence some of those decisions. And I'm not sure it's necessarily a good thing.
Yeah, you get the odd driver who is quite vocal and has found the way to pull levers, like we've talked about Lewis in the past, agitating for change. But then you do have those other drivers who are a little bit more passive and just sort of have that turn up and drive mentality. Is that a driver mindset thing, or is it a teams with a sort of a, you know, you do your bit and let us do our bit sort of mentality?
Yeah, I think it's a little bit of both, isn't it? I mean, there's a, that's a real football pundit's answer, isn't it? That's a little bit of both, really.
It's a game of two halves.
Can I sit comfortably on the fence here and not go either way? But actually,
do you want the cushion?
Yeah, there's a fact that, you know, drivers get the contract. The contract says, you know, you turn up and drive and you get paid all this money or whatever, assuming we're talking about competitive teams. So, and there is a tendency that you're sort of you're contracted as a plug and play solution for the team, and your responsibilities begin and end with driving the car and doing the PR job that you're asked to do outside of the car. But so I think the way in which everything has moved in terms of what drivers are obligated to do has changed. And again, you know, I've experienced in my career where a driver for our team has really got stuck into helping the team to move forward and been rewarded for that. And it's been really important to the team that the driver has done that. And then I've also experienced what happens when a driver starts messing with areas that he knows absolutely nothing about and actually just upsets everyone, because they, you know, when you've got a team of very clever engineers, you've got the driver saying, well, I need to have X, Y, Z, and they're going, actually, you don't, because, you know, none of the data supports that. So, again, you don't get alignment. So I think it all really comes down to individual personalities and characters. And I think this is, again, why when you look at the big players in Formula One, whether it's an Alonso or whether it's a Hamilton or a Vettel, when we talk about their performances and we talk about their career in terms of how it pans out, so often you find it's the dynamic behind the scenes. It's how they've worked within the team. It's whether they've built the team around them, whether they've really contributed to the team or not. And I think with the Vettel situation at the moment, for example, you can, you know, Mark Webber has said recently that, you know, the marriage with Maranello didn't work. And I think that was a very interesting way for him to put it, because, you know, the Vettel-Ferrari management relationship just never panned out in quite the way that he expected. So again, it all comes down to degree of influence that you have on the team, and frankly, whether you can be bothered to put in that extra work on a Monday to Friday basis that you need in order to get the results on a Sunday.
Ben has put together a feature looking at Sebastian Vettel's Ferrari years for this month's issue, and it does make for interesting reading. And also, I was reminded when I went back and I was researching for my column that Vettel was actually basically someone who was a Montezemolo hire before Montezemolo got pushed out. So he was always onto a bit of a hiding to nothing even before he joined. But Ben, you've kind of forensically dissected Vettel's Ferrari career over the course of several pages, and it doesn't make for pretty reading, does it?
No, unfortunately not. I mean, really, it peaked at the start, didn't it? That's the thing I found from kind of reviewing those seasons. Of course, there's still one to go, but I mean, I don't think we expect, or even Ferrari expects, to do much in 2020 with whatever calendar they complete. 2015 was as good as it got, really. You know, he got fresh impetus from going into a new environment. You know, the dream move to the team that his hero raced for, the chance to build this legacy, the kind of romance and joy that all drivers go into Ferrari with at the start, and then it gets ground out of them slowly. chaotic reality dawns. And I think that's where he's been unlucky, because we know that Vettel is a extremely fast driver. We know he's technically astute. We know that he's a really hard worker. Okay, he's not the only one on the grid, and others have maybe caught him up or surpassed him in some aspects. He's driven for Ferrari at a time when there was just, you know, chaos behind the scenes year after year, and management changes and team principal changes and technical restructures, and James Allison falling out with Sergio Marchionne, and then Sergio Marchionne unfortunately passing away well before his time, and just upheaval after upheaval. And I think probably a key period, Vettel, I think he got burned a bit in 2016 when he was trying to play more of the game behind the scenes and take even more of a leadership role outside of the car. And it didn't really work out for him. And I remember Maurizio Arrivabene slapping him down in Japan, giving an interview to, I think it was Italian TV, saying, you know, every employee has to kind of earn their place here. And obviously that subsequently went away, and Vettel had a pretty strong 2017 in probably not quite the best car. Didn't quite get over the line. I think that would have changed things had he managed to execute that title charge. He got a new contract when things were going really well in the first half of the season. But yeah, it always felt like he was on a bit of a hiding to nothing, because they never had the stability. And of course, fast forwarding to 2019, and it's another new broom through that team, a new team principal stamping his own mark on things, a new young driver coming in who's, you know, was considered a mega talent by many teams on his way up. And Ferrari had their hooks into him early, and they've realised the benefit of going down that route. And Vettel's time has suddenly passed, but I don't think it was all his own doing. I know he has made, as I've charted in the feature, a few of his own mistakes, some big ones, some smaller ones, some at very unfortunate and important times. But I think also, and this is the subject that you get into in detail in your excellent column, Codders, he's a victim of circumstance. Ferrari has this long history of kind of undoing the careers of drivers, and it's only very few who've managed to make it work in the right circumstances.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. Have either of you seen the, you know, the Austrian Grand Prix coming up to kick off the delayed Formula One season? I don't know if either of you have seen the Scuderia Ferrari promo video that they've put out with Charles Leclerc and Sebastian Vettel saying how much they're looking forward to the season. You seen that?
No, pass me by.
Okay, so Leclerc is like full of the joys of spring, and I'm really looking forward to racing in Austria. And then Vettel comes on, and I don't know where they recorded it. I think it was like him on his laptop in his bedroom or something. And it's like a crime watch video. I mean, he just doesn't want to be there. You know, he just doesn't want to be there. He looks grim. And a few people have commented, and a few journalists have commented, why Ferrari even agreed to put that video out. He looks awful. And he just looks unhappy. You know, it doesn't look like... It looks like someone has sent him an email saying, listen, the communications department would want to put out a video. Here's the script. Can you just record, you know, 20 seconds of saying how much you're looking forward to Austria? The problem is, I don't think he's looking forward to Austria. I don't think he's particularly relishing what's going on. And it is sad, you know, and therefore, you know, that Ferrari have kind of taken a guy who has given a lot to the sport, and he's very passionate about his position within, you know, the history of Formula One. And he looks like a pretty demoralized person at the moment.
Yeah, he didn't have a handler there to twist his arm and say, look happy.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
But he manages a lot of his own affairs, doesn't he? He just needs a fresh start, doesn't he? You know, he's in an organization that's moved on quite clearly. They've got a new leading light. You know, they've told him in no uncertain terms that you're not the star man anymore. It's all kind of breaking down. But he's got to do a job, hasn't he, for another half a year at least before he can move on. And that's always going to be difficult if you're having to try and give your all for an organization that's made it quite clear that under the terms that you had previously, they don't want you anymore.
Yeah, it's interesting what you say about his kind of the, you know, he looks after his own affairs. David Coulthard's view is that Sebastian has really lacked for having a manager who not only manages his affairs in terms of making sure there are other options, but also manages his affairs by telling him some home truths from time to time. And the difficulty is, I think, with a lot of sports people, actually, when their career have been going on for a few years and they've earned a lot of money and they feel like they know their business really well, they ditch management, as you or I would know it, and they simply employ a lawyer, which is what Sebastian has done, and they have the lawyer and they have a PR guy or girl and they have, a physio and a couple of other people around them, but ultimately they want to make all their decisions. And the point that DC made is that he was being managed by Martin Brundle, and he said there were a few times where Martin came to me and said, you do realize you've got this wrong, and actually here's what's happening, and you need to step back from the coalface, because what you think is your future is not actually the way it's going to pan out. And I think this is an important lesson here for drivers as they mature into their careers. There is a reason why good managers are worth every penny you have to pay them. And if you resent paying them 10 or 15% or whatever it is you're having to pay them, you have to bear in mind the time will come where that person becomes critical to reading the tea leaves and giving you a sense of where you're at. So again, when the Charles Leclerc, when the long-term contract was announced with Charles Leclerc, it was so evident that Vettel was going into whatever his negotiation was likely to be with at least one hand tied behind his back. And he probably wasn't going to get a long-term contract, and he probably wasn't going to be able to retain his position as team leader. So it's probably going to be a bit of a case study as to how not to manage a critical phase of your career.
I don't know if you've been following the actor Richard E. Grant on Twitter recently, but he's been doing a daily quote from his classic role as Withnail in Withnail and I, and I'm not sure if he's got to the bit where he's in the phone box in conversation with his agent and he says, well kiss 10% of the arses for me then, which is what a manager's for, isn't it?
Well, the thing about a manager is a manager can walk into any motorhome having conversations with anyone about anything. They can talk to the press in a way that maybe a driver doesn't, especially if the driver is being protected from the media, you know, 95% of the time. And again, this is something that's changed in Formula One over the years. You not too many years ago had a situation where the key opinion forming journalists, you know, the kind of 15 or 20 key journalists in the paddock, all had really direct personal relationships with the top drivers, and that would involve going and having a lunch or a dinner or, you know, flying somewhere together or whatever. And I think that's kind of dissipated, and it means that a lot of drivers aren't getting that that kind of information about what people are really thinking about their career and opportunities and the way the team is being viewed from the outside, and just getting all of that data, which is so important in order to help you to make the right decision. And the role of a manager in helping, you know, any sports person to understand what's actually happening is so key. And I think all too often for racing drivers, and if there's any young racing drivers listening to this podcast, a lot of young racing drivers associate managers with someone who finds money for you, you know, who finds sponsorship. And management is so much more than just finding you the cash needed to do the job. It's about looking at the big picture of the best teams and people to work with and helping you to make the right strategic decisions. Because, you know, let's face it, the key decisions you make between the ages of 15 and 21 will determine whether you have a long and successful professional career as a motor racing driver.
It is. And certainly this season, not going to be particularly long in terms of anyone's careers, is it? We're looking at the moment at 8 races we've got more or less etched into the calendar at the moment. Whether we actually do anything beyond the putative Monza date is a little bit unknown at the moment. But I suppose there is a joy to be had in the prospect of having 8 races ahead of us. And Mark, your column this month, you focused on the guy at the top of Liberty Media, Darth Vader himself, John Malone. Lots and lots of interesting little moving around of the finances they've been doing to protect F1 at a corporate level. And I knew that John Malone wasn't a man to be trifled with in business, but I didn't realize he was a dab hand at fixing Jaguar XK120 gearboxes. So he's not the sort of the corporate shark that I kind of thought he was. Or if he is, there's sort of hidden depths that you've revealed this month.
Yeah, I mean, what's interesting is to go back and look at his life and how it unfolded from, you know, relatively humble beginnings in Connecticut and a father who was an engineer, a life where as a child, you know, his dad's workshop was always full of radio systems and valves and transmitters. And so he learned how to work with sort of electrical equipment and get old TVs to work. And, you know, they were always basically, he and his dad clearly had a fantastic relationship. And that kind of practical hands-on approach then extended as a teenager to going out and acquiring a sort of a broken down Jaguar XK 120 and then deciding, well, it's broken down for good reason. I'll find out what that reason is. So he sets about stripping the transmission, finds a broken gear, goes and gets a new one, fixes it up, earns a bit of a reputation for himself in the local community, starts getting asked to service other people's cars and fixing them. And it's just... The point that I make in the column is that he quickly realized that if you buy something that's not working very well and then you fix it, you know, you add so much value and people want that. People want to work with people who fix problems and add value. And it's maybe a little bit of a stretch to go from an XK120 gearbox problem to Formula One facing the financial fallout of COVID-19. But the reality is that, you know, he likes a challenge, and and when you read about his career in the telecommunications field and satellite broadcasting, I talk about telecommunications and satellite broadcasting because really it kind of all emerged at the same time. This is all about connecting people with content, and he was doing it with cable TV systems back in the 1970s. A very quick synopsis is to say he became an extremely capable academic, you know, went to Yale University, did a couple of master's degrees, accelerated himself at the age of 30 into, you know, being a senior executive and getting some really good career breaks. But then going and working for a company which manufactured and sold these cable TV systems and building that company into an organization which, in 1998, they were able to sell to AT&T, which was America's big telecoms company at the time, for $48 billion. Now, that's back when $48 billion was a lot of money. But, you know, that was a huge amount of money. And that was a company that over the previous 25 years, I mean, John Malone took from, quite frankly, dire straits, you know, a company that couldn't even meet its debt obligations very, very easily, and turned it into a giant. And that's been the trigger for everything that we've seen since. And a really interesting sort of thing to think about in relation to looking at Malone and how that business has developed is twofold, really. First of all, in the middle of the current crisis that we're seeing in the world and in Formula One with COVID-19, coronavirus, and all the rest of it, first of all, his group has been able to do this kind of shimmy where they move assets from Liberty Media into Liberty Liberty Media, ticker light, the Live Nation assets, shift these assets around, and as a result, pump $1.5 billion in much-needed cash into the Formula One business. And the point of mentioning that in the column is this goes to show the benefit of Formula One having been sold to a diverse media group that has lots of fingers in different pies. They can shift assets around. They can move cash in a way to sustain the business at this critical time. And that is so important because when everyone from Claire Williams to Toto Wolff is looking for Liberty to continue paying the TV based prize money that they're getting this year. And this is money that's keeping the teams alive, quite frankly, at a time when there's no racing. And then going into 2021, when prize money will have dipped significantly because we won't have had the number of races this year. We won't have had perhaps all of the broadcast revenue. We probably won't have had all the sponsorship that's needed. So Liberty's inherent strength is so important to protect Formula One this year, next year, and probably into 2022 as well. And then the final thing that I mentioned in the column, which I thought, you know, and I haven't drawn this conclusion necessarily in the column, but the reason to include the story is that, you know, Liberty Global have recently announced a deal to merge its Virgin Media business. So they own Virgin Media, and they're merging that with Telefonica's O2 mobile phone brand in the UK. Now, for UK listeners, what that means is that John Malone's company is now a major rival to BT. And that actually means that they're also a major rival to Sky. And so what that means is it is not impossible to imagine a scenario where when that exclusive contract for Formula One with Sky comes up for grabs in, you know, a couple of years' time, they'll start negotiating that. It's not impossible that John Malone himself might have one of his businesses, his UK business, bidding to actually take the exclusive rights to Formula One away from Sky. He's created yet another major new player in this market. So there's lots of aspects of Malone's ability to break things down and rebuild them in a different way that is of great interest to all of us in Formula One.
Do you feel like Formula One's in a surer financial place, COVID and crises excepted? Because we've talked about Liberty in the past and perhaps not been quite so sure-footed in terms of how much debt they might have got into in terms of purchasing Formula One and, you know, at a time when revenues are tight. But it sounds like from your investigations into Malone and the inner workings of Liberty that maybe things are a bit more sure-footed than they might have seemed in the past.
I think the criticism of Liberty in terms of perhaps them not understanding Formula One in detail and being on a big learning curve, you know, commercially on a learning curve in terms of, you know, they haven't been able to get the sponsorship in, for example, that they thought was going to be low-hanging fruit when they took over from Bernie Eccleston. You know, some of those criticisms were well-founded. However, the big picture was that in Formula One coming out of being owned by private equity companies, in the case of CVC Capital, into being owned by a media group, it was fundamentally a better thing for the future of Formula One. I can tell you, I would hate to imagine what the situation would be at the moment if CVC were still the owners of Formula One, if Formula One was held by private equity. Because the private equity guys, they're only interested in this quarter, maybe next quarter, definitely the annual earnings. You start talking to them about the fact that you have a problem that's going to wipe out your year. I mean, these guys run for the hills. They're not interested in anything other than sustaining profitability and growth. And therefore, when something unprecedented like this happens, I mean, you only have to read the business papers or listen to the news. So many businesses in the UK and around the world going under at the moment because their shareholders don't have the wherewithal to put in the money that's needed to sustain their businesses through a fundamental crisis. And in the case of Formula One, yes, it's not been pretty, and we've all been waiting to see when the calendar would emerge and all the rest of it. But you know what? What's interesting is that the 10 teams are still there. Formula One is still there. We now have a calendar that's kicking off in July. You know, whether we have a doubleheader in Sochi or, you know, things that people want to complain about, I mean, quite frankly, we're really lucky that it's there. And I think a lot of that is down to Liberty's ability to, first of all, have the cushion of cash that you need. Everyone, to survive this, you need to have a cushion, and you need to have leadership that are willing to put the money in where it needs to be put in to make the business work. And so, you know, Ben, honestly, I think no one could have known back in 2017 when Liberty came on the scene that they were going to help Formula One to weather the worst storm in its 70-year history. But that's what it's turned out to be. And I think we should be pretty relieved they've been around to do that and to work these sort of the financial engineering required to shore up the finances of Formula One and make sure that we live to see better days ahead.
It looks to me as if the participants and the governing body and the commercial rights holder are now aligned as never before, probably because their backs are against the wall, so they've got no choice to be aligned. And as this issue of GP racing went to press, we were just about to witness the ratification of what's been known as the New Deal, haven't we, where there's a new package of rules that will hopefully make it a little bit more economical and also level the playing field. How important do we think that's going to be in terms of either persuading the people who have the wherewithal to stay and also to make it affordable for the likes of Renault, who for a while looked pretty shaky? They've now said that they're definitely in F1 for the medium haul at least, but they even Cyril Abitbol was making only mildly optimistic noises about whether he'd be able to carry on. And now with a lower budget cap and caps on aero development, it looks as if actually everyone's now travelling in the same direction for the next 2 years at least.
You mentioned Cyril and Renault because, if nothing else, this budget cap has ensured their continued involvement in Formula One. And so if it was in doubt, it's now nailed down. So that's great. And that's very, very good news, because this is not an easy time for anyone involved in the automotive industry. And for Renault, it's been as difficult a time as for any. When you see the UK figures, 87% drop in car sales in May, 92% or something in whatever, it was over 90% in April, you know, massive, massive drops in car sales. And so a very easy moment for any manufacturer to turn around and say, you know what, we can't afford to do Formula One. We talked about BMW earlier on in the podcast. You know, BMW, Honda and Toyota ran for the hills in the wake of the financial crisis in 2008. And in terms of economic impact, you know, the COVID-19 crisis globally is worse than a financial crisis in many respects. And so this was an easy out for Renault. And actually, they've looked at it and thought, maybe this is our moment. Maybe we're the perfectly sized Formula One team. The big teams are going to have to downsize. We're not going to necessarily have to downsize. So it plays quite nicely to the structure that we have in place. So that's been really good news. I think the other thing is that it's the timing in many respects couldn't have been better, because in getting the budget cap across the line in the middle of COVID-19 and that news coming out, it actually shows that Formula One is trying to cut its cloth according to the real economic circumstances in which it and the world finds itself, which is that there is going to be less money in the next few years. This is not going to be the time to be asking sponsors for $60 or $70 million to support a team that's spending $300 million on doing Formula One. And so it's actually very timely. It feels like Formula One is almost getting ahead of the game in setting out a stall that looks sustainable. Now, of course, the reality is for the smaller teams, even reaching a budget cap of $145 million will still be problematic. There's plenty of teams that don't even have that money available to them. But it definitely narrows the playing field. And I think the fact that the research and development criteria have been adjusted so that the teams that achieve more will have less opportunity to run aero programs is a very clever move. I'm slightly skeptical as to whether it'll have quite the impact that everyone thinks, because the big teams will continue to have the better facilities and the brighter people. And I think every aero run that they do on CFD or every wind tunnel run will necessarily be more impactful simply because of their scale and the capability of what they've got. And meanwhile, the smaller teams in some ways can do as many aero runs as they want, and they'll probably not catch up with the big ones just because, again, it's just about inherent capability. But it definitely makes a move towards the kind of structure that shows that the governing body in Formula One is trying to create a more level playing field. And I think at a time when McLaren are looking for investment, when Williams are looking for investment or potentially a sale, it couldn't have come along better. It's been much needed. And I think there will be investors and potential new owners thinking, actually, Formula One has done just what we needed at the current time, because to continue as we had before seemed unsustainable.
Yeah, there's nothing like a crisis to focus minds, is there? And I think the timing element is really important, especially when we talk about a team like Renault, because they and McLaren, I think, are the teams closest to the budget cap level, and they were the ones probably most vocal in pushing for that to come in where it has done. And I remember Cyril Abitbol talking even as far back as end of 2016, 2017, that his plan for Renault was to try and beat the top teams on 85% of their budget or total resources anyway. So this budget cap only strengthens his position, because if you cap those top teams at the budget cap level, that's a reduction of nearer 50%. So it all strengthens his case to remain in Formula One. Of course, the only thing is Renault might commit now on the basis that they're making severe cuts in other places, but we don't know what the reality is going to be in 6 months' time when you're looking at 2021, and Liberty maybe can't subsidize the teams in the same way that it has done this year. And then you've got maybe more difficult questions to have at boardroom level to say, well, we need this budget to do this. And have we recovered sales? Nobody knows. We're all hoping that, post COVID there's a recovery, but how steep that is, when it happens, where it happens, which sectors just don't ever get the right bounce back, can't be known. So I mean,
this is what you're raising, a really important point there, Ben, which is that, everyone's thinking about, my goodness, the impact on this year. As you're alluding to, and as I mentioned, it's what's going to be really interesting is 2021, because the prize money from this year is what the pot will be. That's being determined this year for next year. And the simple fact of the matter is that, let's just say Liberty get all of the TV contracts fulfilled. So let's say they get 15 races or 16 races away and they get all the TV contracts fulfilled. That's great news. They're not going to get the revenue from the events. That's very clear. And actually, they're paying for some of the events to take place. It feels to me like the prize fund might be kind of half the size, and that might still be going some to get a half the amount of money being made available next year to the teams that is made available this year. And it'll be really interesting to see, therefore, what the impact is. So I think first year of the budget cap, it might look great, but actually if the smaller teams are only being given $20 to $30 million instead of $40 to $50 million, they still have a heck of a lot of cash to find in order to compete even within that budget cap.
Yeah, and I think that's probably why Liberty would have wanted to go further if they could. It always felt to me like, even before this present crisis, that their long-term strategy was to reduce the spend that the teams were making so that they could also reduce the prize pot. The whole thing had to shrink really to be sustainable, and it was how you edged everybody towards that reality. And COVID has accelerated that process, as it's accelerated the decline of other things. Reckonings that were going to happen in 3 to 5 years are happening now, and I think that's going to be the reality in the future for the Formula One teams. They've agreed the budget cap at $145 million. Probably it needs to be more than that, but this is just the first step to getting them to wake up to the fact that there's just not going to be the money floating around in 2021, 2022, maybe beyond. And yeah, if you want to make up the shortfall because you've got a rich owner or several investors, or you can find sponsorship, then great. But in terms of the bottom line, as you mentioned, the small teams, they're never going to make that 145. It's even less likely once the TV deals and the prize pot shrinks. So there's going to be more difficult conversations down the line, I think, about reducing spending even further, probably.
We can now gain a kind of further understanding of why Zak Brown at McLaren was saying, he was all for $100 million budget cap. And, you know, when we first heard that a couple of months ago, we were thinking, well, that's just never going to happen. You know, how could it possibly come down to $100 million? Now it actually doesn't look like such a mad idea because of what we've just spoken about. And of course, since then, and as I'll be talking about in my column in next month's edition of Grand Prix Racing Magazine, McLaren are going through, McLaren Group, I hasten to add, are going through a horrendous time. And the Formula One team, you know, needs to save every penny and needs to be given a helping hand by Formula One in terms of allowing it to remain a competitive team in an environment of scarcity. And that's going to be an environment for the next couple of years.
A month and a half ago, we were wondering what Zak Brown had been smoking when he was talking about a $100 million budget cap. And we thought, well, no one will ever agree to that. And why is McLaren asking for this? And then, of course, the news filtered out that they were, you know, trying to raise another bond, mortgaging the factory, mortgaging the car collection, having a little bit of a whoopsie when it was discovered that maybe actually those assets had already been mortgaged for the previous bond issue to pay Ron Dennis off. So underneath that smooth and highly polished surface of the McLaren Technology Center, it just feels like all's not been well for the past 3 years, really, since they decided that Ron had to go.
It's like Ross Brawn said, isn't it, that Formula One's a pretty uncompromising world. And if you have any sustained period of lack of success, as McLaren has done very recently, and Williams, you know, for longer and more recently, the money just dries up. And not only the money that comes from Formula One itself, but your ability to attract new investors, new sponsors, all of it just enters a death spiral, really. And then something like this comes along, just accelerates all the problems that you already had, and any that you weren't able to get on to tackling just become even bigger. I think the other interesting thing in this emerging dynamic is the fact that you've now got both Ferrari and Mercedes, the mightiest teams in Formula One, the biggest spenders, actually saying, you know, previously they were saying, oh, you know, budget cap, what are we going to do with these thousands of employees? You know, do we just turf them out on the street? I think that's a comment Niki Lauda made when this was, you know, first on the kind of, or first back on the agenda. But of course, now they're looking at diversifying into other forms of motorsport. They're thinking, yeah, actually, there is no way we can do Formula One in the way that we have done. It's just not going to be possible in the next few years. So we're going to have to start looking at ways that we can save these jobs and protect these people by actually farming them out to other areas of the business. Red Bull too. Christian Horner has been saying, you know, we've got this Red Bull Technologies business. They're going to be people who are going to have to move across and start doing different things because we are not going to be able to do Formula One in the same way. And they accept that it's not sustainable unless it changes drastically. And as I say, this is the first step, I think, on that road, but not the last.
It's interesting that therefore, out of all this doom and gloom, the silver lining could be that companies of Ferrari and Mercedes-Benz standing and Red Bull standing end up going into other categories of racing and support those categories at a time when they too are going through difficulties in the wake of COVID-19. And if Ferrari do end up racing at the Indianapolis 500, how exciting is that for global motorsport? Actually, I would argue it's really good for Formula One, because the halo effect of Formula One then reaches beyond into those audiences equally, you know, for either of those brands to turn up at Le Mans and do the Le Mans 24 hours and get involved in sports car racing. It potentially is all really quite good news. And the thing is, for companies of Ferrari and Mercedes standing and capability, when they decide, right, well, we're going to move those 20% of employees onto these other projects, they also have the strength to bring sponsors with them, to bring key technical partners and suppliers, because all of these big manufacturers, Mercedes and Ferrari, they've got a lot of partners who want to work with them in whatever category of racing they move into. So the silver lining to all of this could be a diversification, which in many ways has been much needed for a long time. It's been a pity that not only do Formula One drivers only race in Formula One, but it's also been a pity that Formula One teams only race in Formula One, when there is so much inherent capability for them to turn their hands to other things. So, you know, who knows, it might be the beginning of quite an interesting era for motorsport in this decade.
And a return to the good old days as well, where these teams did multiple disciplines and entered various championships. So we could be going back to the start or back to the future.
Are you putting on John Inverdale spectacles there, Ben?
What colour are those spectacles?
They're rose tinted or rose coloured. Definitely not a portmanteau of the two. But there, I remember John Surtees always used to say that nothing got done at Ferrari on the F1 cars until Le Mans was over. That's probably not a situation anyone wants to happen. But equally, the McLaren. The McLaren F1 car, the GT project with that went ahead with Ron's feet, well, or his ankles making grooves in the floor because he didn't want it to go racing. It was only Ray Belm came and said, look, I'll give you pots of money, turn it into a race car. And Ron showed no interest in the Le Mans campaign, and you know, you had a McLaren winning Le Mans and Ron not even there because obviously it raced in the rain. So the car ended the race wet and dirty. So just the thought of it made me give him shivers.
Also, I think the fact that it had a BMW engine in it probably was slightly embarrassing for McLaren, yes, Mercedes at the time.
Sponsorship on the winning car from a Tokyo-based vasectomy clinic. So no doubt they got that real estate at a snip. But
I knew there was a joke. There was a punchline in there about to emerge.
You've left it late this time, Godders.
That was
you've stolen in there at the last.
How many years have you been sitting on that one?
There's a couple of us who do it occasionally on Twitter. Me and Toby Moody usually drop in the Ueno clinic gag. Henry Hope Frost, when he was still alive, would do that as well. So bless him. We'd have a little bounce around of the Ueno gag. But who knows? Who knows? Well, I think we've probably come up to about our sort of time limit. We've got to this point in the afternoon without either of my cats trying to break in, demanding an early dinner. So I'd say it's a bit of a result. Let's convene again in 4 weeks' time. Hopefully now we're back on a normal GP racing schedule, by which time racing will be just about to resume. One of my jobs for this week is to write previews again, because obviously we were doing the Australian preview only 2 or 3 months ago. But yeah, I've got some race previews to write. We will actually have current racing in our magazine. So without further ado, I'll say thank you very much, Mark Gallagher. We'll speak to you again in a month with your perfectly pristine office, freshly dusted. Thank you, Ben Anderson. Hopefully, I think you might need to run the feather duster over that curtain pole in the background.
I'll get right on it.
Thank you, everyone, for listening. I've been Stuart Codding. We will be publishing another one of these podcasts in another month as we look forward to our second 2020 season preview edition of GP Racing. The producer, as ever, doing a brilliant job, is Martin Lee. Thank you very much.